From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Nearly 2 years ago, on a public street in broad daylight, a prominent filmmaker was brutally murdered by a Dutch-born Muslim who claimed to be acting in defense of Islam. Across Europe, the shocking crime came to be seen as a symbol of social crisis, and it inspired Ian Baruma to return to his native Holland and investigate the story behind the violence. The result is his 11th book, Murder in Amsterdam, The Death of Theo van Gogh, or Theo van Gogh, and The Limits of Tolerance. It's published by Penguin, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Ian Baruma back to my show today. Hello. How are we going to pronounce his name? The Dutch way or the American way?
I think probably the American way is simpler.
Okay, Theo van Gogh. So what happened on the morning of November 2nd, 2004?
Well, Theo van Gogh was bicycling to his work, as many commuters do in Amsterdam, and Mohamed Bouyeri, his killer, bicycled towards the place where he knew van Gogh would pass, shot him in the stomach. Van Gogh crawled across the street, begged for his life, and Mohamed Bouyeri slashed his throat and pinned a pamphlet to his chest with another knife, full of basically saying death to Holland, death to the West, death to infidels, etc., etc.
And he had been born in Holland.
Absolutely. Dutch is his native language, and he might speak a bit of Berber. His parents were from Morocco, but he's entirely Dutch.
Are there a lot of people from Morocco in the Netherlands? Because I know that Indonesia, which is the world's most populous Muslim country, used to be a Dutch colony. There are a couple of other countries that were Dutch colonies that also had a lot of Muslims, and they came after independence, but I never thought of North Africa as a
place.
Well,
there were never many Indonesian immigrants. The ones that were there were Eurasians, and they weren't particularly Muslim. Dutch Guiana is the other big colony, and they're mostly of African origin and not Muslim either. What happened is that in Holland, Germany, Belgium, France, during the 1960s, when the economies boomed, they got a lot of so-called guest workers, and they were mostly from Turkey and Morocco, single men, and they were later joined by their families and then had children, and then they gradually, sort of almost by default, without anybody quite noticing, became this huge immigrant population.
And Mohamed Bouyeri was caught right away. Did he want to get caught?
He wanted to get killed. He wanted to die as a martyr. He said so. It was a disappointment to him that although the police shot at him and caught his leg, I think, that he didn't die for his cause.
So this is the equivalent of being a suicide bomber.
Yes, in effect it is. Yes.
Why were you interested in this story? I mean, similar stories have occurred. What sent you back home?
Partly because I knew Van Gogh personally a little bit. It's my native country. I was interested to find out what had changed since I left in 1975. And it's a very interesting story because it dramatizes through several very colorful characters a problem that all Europeans are facing now: what to do with a minority inside a minority that has attached itself to a violent revolutionary cause that seeks to destroy the countries they live in.
Did everybody have an opinion?
Everybody has an opinion on this, yes.
And they were open?
Everybody talked to me. I didn't speak to people deep in the jihadi movement, but I had no trouble talking to anybody. It's very polarized and emotional, the debate. So the people in my book, whom I didn't describe in a way that they liked, have become sort of quite angry, and it's all very fraught.
What impact did the trial have? Was it cathartic in some way?
I wouldn't say so, no. I think that the problems are deep-seated, and I don't think they were changed by the trial. I think that the anxiety about immigrants, about Islam and so on, existed before and were exploited by the right-wing politician Pim Fortuyn, or the populist politician. But the murder, I think, caused a kind of panic. That all the things people thought were wonderful and great, like multiculturalism and so on, suddenly people turned and said, it's all been a disaster. And I'm not sure that that's quite true.
But you also discovered that multiculturalism isn't that rosy thing that many people would like to think it is in the Netherlands. Why did the police officers who attended Boyeri's trial find themselves crying? During his testimony.
Well, it is a bizarre scene, these cops sort of falling into each other's arms and crying when they remembered the murder. People are not used to serious violence in Dutch society. People always thought it was relatively peaceful, I mean, more peaceful than anywhere else. It was liberal, and, you know, the stereotype, which is, of course, a myth, but it says something about the self-image of the Dutch, too, of you know, Amsterdam policemen smoking dope in the streets and that kind of thing. And suddenly, in this peaceful, liberal oasis, something like this happens.
Well, there are other Muslims in the Netherlands who've assimilated, like the Turks.
Absolutely. And one of the interesting things is the question why the Moroccans should... things like street crime are more associated with Moroccans than they are with Turks. One explanation is that the Turks are better organized. They have community organizations and so on. And a stronger sense of national identity. They're proud of Turkey, even if they're Dutch. Whereas the Moroccans are not from the big cities. They're from little villages in the Rif Mountains. They're villages. They're a bit like Sicilians. They're clannish, but they have very little other cohesion. And so the young men in that community find themselves often adrift, neither at home in Europe nor obviously in the villages of their fathers.
Is there a difference between the immigrants who came as permanent residents and those who arrived as guest workers?
Well, there is a difference between the guest workers and their offspring. The guest workers basically worked themselves to the bone, not particularly religious. They're village people who try to survive as best they could. It's their children and grandchildren who are asserting a religious identity. Not all of them. I mean, many of them, especially the women, are very hardworking. The universities are full of them, and they're industrious precisely because they want to liberate themselves from the grip often of their menfolk.
But isn't this kind of opposite to what we have seen in the past, at least with the young men? Usually immigrants came and brought strong memories of the country that they'd left behind, try to maintain as many of the traditions as possible, got upset when their kids became assimilated. What we're seeing here is the immigrants becoming relatively assimilated, and then their children wanting to make that connection to the country that they may never have seen.
That's true. Of course, that's not only true of Moroccans or Muslims. I mean, it is a particular pattern that if children feel their parents have assimilated too much, it seems a bit abject, craven, spineless, and then the children who feel more assured of themselves suddenly start to identify with a religion or a culture more stringently or more radically than their parents ever would have.
My guest is Ian Baruma. His latest book is Murder in Amsterdam, The Death of Theo van Gogh and the Limits of Tolerance, published by Penguin. And as you suggested earlier, the Netherlands is one of the most progressive countries in the world. It has legalized drugs, prostitution, euthanasia, gay marriage. So how do those progressive politics translate into the treatment of immigrants?
Well, one of the reasons that Pim Fortuyn, who, of course, tapped into the same anxieties that far-right politicians in other parts of Europe did, but what made him different is that, and not just a straightforward right-winger, is that he was a flamboyantly gay man himself. And I say flamboyant because he really was. He made a show of it. And his line, which you wouldn't find with a far-right politician in France or Germany, was that these Muslims are a threat, precisely because they threaten our liberal values. We fought for gay liberation and female emancipation, and here you have these Muslims, and they're trying to undermine it all.
But the Netherlands was a country that was always very proud of the way it welcomed immigrants. It welcomed the Jews who were fleeing the Inquisition. It welcomed the Puritans who were fleeing persecution in England, and I'm pretty sure pretty much everybody else, until the horrors of World War II, where they turned out to be less, I don't know what word.
Less heroic.
Less heroic than one would expect. Yeah. They left that to their Danish neighbors. The Netherlands has always had a reputation for being a country where immigrants could go.
Yes, they could go there, and even now, I mean, there are no pogroms. I mean, if you're a Muslim in a big Dutch city, nobody's going to attack you. Tolerance, of course, can also be a form of indifference, and I think people were allowed to come, and they were left alone, as long as they left others alone. And Jews didn't had a better time in Holland than in many countries, but it wasn't all that great either. For a long time, they couldn't do the kind of jobs that non-Jews could. But they were left, they were not molested. That's the big thing. In this case, indifference clearly wasn't enough.
And your subtitle is The Death of Theo van Gogh and the Limits of Tolerance. So have recent developments in the Netherlands then made the Dutch aware of the limits of their tolerance?
I think so. Theo van Gogh was, of course, of the persuasion that anything whatsoever should be able to be said, no matter how offensive.
Now that he was a wild man when he was a guest on this show.
And not just with Muslims. I mean, he offended everybody. There are limits to that, clearly. But I think, yes, I think people have become more cautious. And the recent case in Berlin of Idomeneo, the opera that had to be taken off, I hope temporarily, is an example of this too.
But the Netherlands has had, my memories of the Netherlands have been of this country that's kind of schizophrenic. That's the wrong word, actually, but have had a very divided sensibility. On the one hand, everybody seemed to be very sedate and proper and quiet. And then you had this Provo tradition, an anarchist tradition where people did wild things to provocate.
Well, the wild stuff is mostly in Amsterdam. I mean, just like you have New York and you have the rest of the United States, Amsterdam and Holland, of course, are not quite the same thing. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I think, that Holland does have a tradition of tolerance. There is no tradition of right-wing violence or anything like that. On the other hand, like many European countries, and unlike the United States, say, its identity is not founded on political institutions. It's founded on a kind of club-like sense of shared codes and manners, and it's very difficult for outsiders to find a place in that.
Well, does tolerance in this case, or in the Dutch sense, necessarily imply moral relativism?
I think, well, the defenders of multiculturalism, radical defenders of multiculturalism, of course, did go in that direction and said, you know, cultures are different, that we all have different values, and they're all just as good, and who are we to say that, say, female circumcision is not good for young girls? That kind of opinion has now dwindled. I mean, you don't hear that very much anymore.
But Enlightenment values is a phrase that came up a lot in the conversations you had.
Yes, and I'm suspicious of it because I believe that in this sort of clash of civilizations, I don't think it's a clash of civilizations, but people who do tend to use the Enlightenment, even the Pope, if oddly enough for a Catholic, use the Enlightenment almost as shorthand for Western civilization, for the West. And whereas 50 years ago, a conservative politician would have talked about standing up for Christian values, you can no longer do that in secular Europe. People would laugh at you. So now it's suddenly become Enlightenment values.
But if Christians and Jews can be religious and European, why can't Muslims?
Well, I believe that they can. And I think,
but there seems to be a difference here. Is it because Muslims are being more outspoken about their religious
beliefs? Well, it's partly because too many of them, of course, are questioning things that undoubtedly are the fruits of the Enlightenment. I mean, for example, the separation of church and state is not as clear to many Muslims as it is to secular Europeans or even Christians and Jews in Europe. So I think there are elements of friction there which have to be taken seriously.
Ian Baruma is currently the Luce Professor at Bard College. His previous books include God's
Dust,
I'm sorry, Behind the Mask, The Missionary and the Libertine, Playing the Game, The Wages of Guilt, Anglomania, Bad Elements, and now his latest is Murder in Amsterdam, The Death of Theo van Gogh and the Limits of Tolerance. It is published by Penguin. Stay with us. Ian Buruma's latest book is Murder in Amsterdam, The Death of Theo van Gogh and the Limits of Tolerance. It's published by Penguin. Throughout the West, you still have nominally Christian or Jewish social organizations, hospitals, universities that are for the most part secular. Would having equivalent Muslim institutions go a long way to putting people at ease with Islam?
Well, they do. Unlike in France, where if you want to set up a Catholic school, say, you have to pay for it yourself. In Holland, because political life and social life used to be divided along so-called pillars, all of which represent particular religious denominations, religiously founded schools are all funded by the state. And so you have Catholic schools, Protestant schools, and Muslim schools. And, of course, a lot of people criticize this.
And then you don't have the same kinds of issues you have in France. Young women are allowed to wear headscarves, for example.
Yes, there is no legal sense of lay, what is it called, laïcité in French. There are no laws against wearing headscarves in public places. But the Minister of Immigration and Integration, Rita Verdonk, a hardliner who got in trouble with Ayaan Hirsi Ali recently, she seriously suggested that burqas should be entirely forbidden in all public places.
So is that what happened with Mohamed Bouyeri? He starts out as a good student, a child of immigrants who has managed to fit in with European culture, and then his story starts to sound eerily similar to some of the 9/11 hijackers, some of whom also came from Europe and had adapted to Western ways before they became radicalized. Is it because of the changes in the Netherlands, Pim Fortuyn?
I don't think so. I think he also sounds eerily similar to some of the revolutionaries, Russian revolutionaries, often described by Joseph Conrad in his novels. I mean, young men can
under
be
Western
very,
eyes?
Yes, under Western eyes in particular. Young men can get very confused, and especially young men such as Mohamed Bouyeri, who don't really feel at home anywhere, and can get very angry. And a ready-made cause that gives them an identity, gives them a great mission to die for and so on, for such people can be very attractive.
But he is also living in, however tolerant the society is, a relatively homogeneous society. There's an old story about an American ambassador to Denmark who remarked that in the United States we have two political parties and 100 ways to celebrate Christmas. But in Denmark, they have 100 political parties and only one way to celebrate Christmas.
Well, as I said, there is a little bit of that sort of...
I mean, it's a lot more comfortable for a Muslim to grow up in the United States.
Yes.
Even though there have been tensions here.
I think that's absolutely true. But the difference, of course, is that... one difference is that they don't dominate any city in the United States except possibly Dearborn, Michigan. But in European cities, the overwhelming majority of immigrants are Muslim. And in the larger cities, it's now almost 50% of the population that is of immigrant stock. And so the shock is greater than it would be in the United States.
You write about a psychologist who studied immigrants and found that the first generation tends to be depressed while their children will tend towards schizophrenia.
The boys. He made a distinction between the sons and the daughters. The sons tend towards schizophrenia because of this confusion, because on the one hand, feeling left out of the sort of liberal society in which they were born, and on the other hand, feeling cut off from the society of the village society, often of their fathers, and so they seek. So that leads to a kind of split personality, and what they seek is some ideology that can give them a very rigid sense of rules and values that somehow would solve this schizophrenic problem.
But there are also the other aspects of being the child of immigrants. Often you speak the language and your parents don't, so you wind up being the translator for your parents, in some cases actually being the adult in a situation, having to sign, read complicated papers. You in many cases, if immigrants open up a business, you wind up working in the store as though you were an adult. And I would think that that can really confuse a lot of immigrant children.
Yes, I think so. And in some cases, give them a sense of humiliation, too. They see their parents being humiliated, which undermines the authority of their parents. And then this can add to their sense of resentment in general.
Is there a hyphenation process there, as there is here, where we might have Irish Americans, Mexican Americans, Pakistani Americans, Jewish Americans?
Well, I wish that were true. I like to use hyphens myself, but it's very unorthodox Dutch. In Dutch, they speak of the allochtones and autochtones, meaning those basically the sort of the people bred inside and those bred outside. And this gives it a particularly sort of ethnic dimension, which I find very disturbing. So I wish we could have hyphenated identities, and if one is an optimist, one will believe that in a few generations that will be the case.
Well, one major problem of Moroccan Dutch families seems to be the isolation of women who often arrive as young, illiterate brides for men who are already living in the Netherlands, and they keep them veiled and at home. Why aren't Dutch-born men taking Dutch-born wives?
Well, the ones, some of them do, of course, and probably more and more of them will, and many of the women, the daughters, do get Dutch husbands. I think the reason one is given is that the more confused and the more vulnerable they feel, the more comfortable they are with a woman flown in from a village in Morocco who will be more submissive and more under their control.
But in Denmark, didn't they pass laws that made it difficult to import a spouse?
Yes, the same is true in Holland. I think it's much more difficult now than it was 10 years ago.
There's a story in the New York Times recently about from the reporter on the Islam beat, about a form of speed dating that blends some traditions of arranged marriage with American-style courtship. Anything like that happening in Holland?
I haven't seen it, but anything is possible in this weird time.
My guest is Ian Baruma. His latest book, Murder in Amsterdam, The Death of Theo van Gogh and the Limits of Tolerance, from Penguin Books. This is WNYC 93.9, AMA20. We're online at WNYC.org. Instead of lamenting the domestic violence that occurs in patriarchal immigrant communities, why can't the Dutch authorities punish perpetrators just as they would in a Dutch community?
Well, I think sometimes they try. Of course, it's very difficult for the state or the police to intervene in domestic cases anyway. But I think that they are trying to do that. I think that the days that people were simply left alone to do whatever they wanted, even if it was against the law, just because it was their culture, I think that those days are really over. I mean, there are still people who talk that way, but I don't think that's the mainstream.
But isn't the laxity of the Dutch legal system part of the problem? If Mohamed Bouyeri served only 12 weeks in jail for slashing a police officer's throat before this thing happened, you have to wonder what kind of punishment people would get for spousal abuse.
Well, indeed. The Dutch legal system is not particularly punitive, although Mohamed Bouyeri has very little chance of ever getting out of jail until the day he dies.
Well, in this case, it was different, but he slashed a policeman's throat. I can't imagine
slash his throat is a slightly exaggerated way of putting it. I think he got into a fight in a public park, and he had a knife in his hand, and he sort of lunged at the policeman and nicked his cheek or something of that sort. I mean, he didn't actually slash his throat, but it was nasty enough. That might have merited slightly more punishment.
Since lawmakers can't seem to influence what goes on in these homes, they've gotten involved in the way that Islam is expressed outside the home. So the headscarf has become a hot button issue. But isn't it patronizing to assume that Muslim women are forced to wear the veil rather than choosing to wear the veil?
Well, I think you have both. This is, again, why it's such a complicated issue. There are no doubt cases where they are forced to wear the veil because their parents insist on it, or because in their neighborhoods, and you hear this in France perhaps a bit more than in Holland, they would be molested by other Muslim boys if they didn't wear the veil. They would be treated as sluts and so on. But I think many of them do choose it. And you see, one of the encouraging things in a place like Amsterdam is that you see women in veils walking arm, linking arms with their sisters or friends who are in cut-off jeans.
Well, one young law student told you that forcing women to take off their veils when working in public sector jobs makes them feel mentally disappeared. What do you think she meant by that?
Well, I think she was lamenting the fact that she couldn't really work for her own as a civil servant in her own city if she wore the veil, and she feels like a citizen. She wants to have a job like that, and so she felt that if you wear the veil, people sort of almost pretend you don't exist.
Now, in the case of Theo van Gogh, he made this film that outraged an awful lot of Muslims. And to be honest, unlike some of the other things, it was understandable. I'm not saying that he shouldn't have been able to do it, I believe, in free speech. But you could understand why people would have been outraged. To think that someone like Boyeri just would have eventually done this sort of thing with somebody else, or was it the nature of the provocation, the film, and the way the film really went after Muslims, and then he would go on television and say things that we can't say on radio here about Muslims. It was just shocking.
Yes, but I think, to answer your question, I do think it could have happened even without the film. I mean, the film was certainly provocative, but the main target, actually, of Boyeri's rage was not Theo van Gogh, who sort of helped make the film and took care of the technical details as a friendly gesture to the woman who actually wrote the film.
The Sudanese.
The Somali-born
Somali, yeah.
Dutch politician, now with the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, Ayaan Hirsi Ali. She wrote it as a way to provoke people into thinking about Muslim abuse of women, and she blames it on the Quran. And so she was being deliberately provocative, and she's the one that Boyeri really wanted to get.
But he didn't go after her.
He didn't go after her because she, unlike Theo van Gogh, she already had protection.
Now, are there things that the Dutch could have done to prevent this sort of thing?
I certainly think that they were lax in terms of security. That, again, because it's not a society that's used to this kind of violence, which is why it caused such a shock. And I think that, and although Theo van Gogh himself refused to have bodyguards, I think the city should have insisted because of the consequences of something like this.
Well, as you said, this is a society unused to violence, and yet the two biggest stories that have come out of Holland over the past 5 years have been assassinations.
Well, yes, but I mean, there are not that many stories that come out of Holland that would reach the headlines anyway, so it would have to be pretty shocking to put the country on the map at all.
Why are so many people in Europe treating Van Gogh's death as a cautionary tale rather than a call to arms?
Well, I think some people are talking about it as a call to arms. I'm not sure I don't know about the figures, but I think you have both people in both camps. You have those who say this shows that we now have to stand up to the barbarians at the gate, and there are those who see it as a cautionary tale, and that's what makes the debate in Europe at the moment so emotional and heated.
Well, the reason I mention that is something you just brought up a little earlier, the cancellation in Berlin of a Mozart opera because there was fear of offending Muslims.
Yes, but then that was immediately followed by so much protest that they now have to find a way of putting it back on again.
Although there are many people are pointing out that the European right, which has often been has not really been all that involved with free speech and the rights of free expression in the past, is yelling loudest about these things.
Yes, because freedom of speech is all very well when it suits them. It's perhaps less welcome when it's exercised in ways that they don't like.
You, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who has caused more political turmoil after Theo van Gogh was killed, as you said, is now here in Washington, D.C. Do you think she left partly because she felt threatened in the same way that Salman Rushdie left England?
I have no doubt, because it's really an awful life that you can't even go buy a tube of toothpaste without having the permission of your bodyguards. And so I think she did want to leave for that reason, and possibly also because she would quite like a bigger stage.
So where do you go from here? I mean, you've been writing about large international issues, and now went back to your homeland to cover this story. Do you see this as a large international issue that just happens to be located
yes.
in the Netherlands?
I think the particular often is a way to deal with the universal, and I think it is a large international issue and encapsulated in this very Dutch story.
And again, the subtitle is "The Limits," includes the words "The Limits of Tolerance." This is something that we all have to grapple with.
Absolutely. And in some way it has to be negotiated. And I mean, when people say free speech is absolute, of course, in effect it's not. As you just mentioned, there are things we can't say on air on in a serious radio program like this.
So and it changes, it's flexible even
it's
in
flexible,
this country.
It's flexible. Community leaders have a lot of influence and so on. So there are always things that cannot be said. And so I'm against those who are absolutist, like Theo van Gogh, in defending who think that anything should be able to be said, but I'm also against being intimidated by people who threaten violence simply because you want to criticize them or even ridicule them.
Ian Baruma is the Luce Professor at Bard College and the author of 11 books, the most recent one, Murder in Amsterdam, The Death of Theo van Gogh and the Limits of Tolerance. It is published by Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.